when I was an atheist, I was not capable of believing something without evidence. And that is still true. That, there's no difference as a Christian.
You're listening to All About Jack, a C.S. Lewis podcast. I'm William O'Flaherty from EssentialCSLewis.com. And today I'm speaking with Dr. Holly Ordway, author of Not God's Type, An Atheist Academic Lays Down Her Arms. Holly has been my guest for several essay chats, and she also has been a co-host when I did a series of podcasts with Dr. Michael Ward on the Narnia Code. Welcome back to All About Jack, Holly.
Well, it's a pleasure to be back on, William. I've had just a great time being on your show before in these the essay chats and on the Narnia Code podcast, so thanks for welcoming me back.
Well, certainly, and now we actually spoke in late 2011 about the first edition of Not God's Type. In fact, you were one of the first interviews related to C.S. Lewis that I had done. This was even before I had a standalone podcast called All About Jack. Well, now, my online presence has changed over the years, and your life has as well. In fact, that's why you're here. However, before getting into that information, for those who haven't heard of you before, let's start by having you take a few moments to cover some of the basic details about what you do now.
Well, I'm currently the director of the MA in Christian Apologetics and specifically in Cultural Apologetics at Houston Baptist University. And this is a very exciting move for me. I've been here 2 years now at the time of this podcast, and we have a full-fledged on-ground and fully online program where we're doing cultural apologetics and really teaching people how to engage with culture and the arts, as well as with philosophy and theology. And it's a very exciting venture. And listeners of your podcast will probably be interested to know that Dr. Michael Ward is actually my colleague now in this program. He's on the faculty and teaches on C.S. Lewis and teaches on literature and apologetics. So this is a really exciting position to be in. And that's my academic work and my teaching work, which I love. And I'm also have been continuing to write the book that we're talking about today, but also my academic work, which focuses primarily on Inkling studies. I'm also now the Charles Williams subject editor for the Journal of Inkling Studies, which is an excellent journal on C.S. Lewis and the other Inklings that I definitely recommend people check out if they're interested in academic work in that area. And I can continuing to write on Lewis, on Williams, and on Tolkien in my academic work.
Well, now, let's dive into one of the more obvious and maybe something that's a little less evident question that I believe relate to each other, and that is why a new edition of your spiritual autobiography and why a revised subtitle?
Well, that's a great question, William, and this revised subtitle is indicative of the fact that this is not just a second edition, but a complete rewrite. It's significantly longer than the first edition. It's almost twice as long. And even the parts that were still, from the original edition have been revised considerably. And there's a couple of reasons why I did this, and I'm really, really happy about it. It's a fantastic opportunity for an author to revisit a published book and effectively treat it as a rough draft. The main impetus behind revising it was to think through more fully my experiences when I became Christian. Because even though the book came out in 2010, I actually wrote it in 2008, which was only 2 years after I had become a Christian. And I did my best to, reflect on the experiences that I had had. But, there's a lot that you can't really understand fully until you've more depth and, lived the Christian life a little bit more fully. And so I found in 2013, when I had the Ignatius Press picked up the reprint of it, and I had the opportunity to revise, and I could have revised either a lot or a little, and I found myself realizing that there was so much that I had touched on or alluded to or hinted at in the first version that really was calling for a fuller exploration. One of those areas came from actually the really great questions that I was getting at conferences when I spoke about my journey. People would ask me, well, what was your childhood like? You mentioned that you didn't have a religious upbringing, but what does that mean? And I hadn't talked about that. And another question that kept coming up was, well, why were you so strongly an atheist? What got you to that point? These are really great questions. And so I wanted to go back and reflect on the roots of my atheism and to go further back and say, well, okay, if this is the story of my conversion, I'm only telling really part of the story unless I go back and I look at how did I become the woman that I was at the point that I was struggling with these ideas about Christianity. And as I did that, I found also that I was recognizing much more fully the role that literature had played in my coming to faith. And this chimed with the fact that now in my academic work, I'm exploring much more the role of literature and the imagination in apologetics, and realizing from my own experiences that it had a really profound role. And what I was able to recognize as I reflected more deeply on my experiences was that the literature that I had read as a child, the Chronicles of Narnia, in particular the Lord of the Rings, but also folk tales, mythology, legends of King Arthur, all of that, really was an avenue of grace. I wouldn't have understood it as that at the time, but it was. And that stayed with me. And it stayed with me in some way, even through the periods of my strongest atheism. And this allowed me in the second edition to be much deeper in my exploration of how it was that I came to faith, because I was able to realize that it wasn't so much a abrupt turnaround, but rather a tipping point. And I think that will be helpful for folks to read and understand the way that, you know, God's grace can work over long periods of time, and that it can have a really powerful effect working through the imagination and through the arts, even when I didn't realize that it was happening, that it was. But I also was able to carry the story forward a good bit, because at the time that I wrote the first edition, I was a relatively new Christian, and I was learning how to be an Anglican, and I was an Anglican. And then, you know, over time, as I continued to grow in my faith and, you know, explore the different traditions in Christianity, I ended up actually becoming Catholic, and I became a Catholic in 2012. And so as I was revising this book in 2013, I was able to account for this step in my journey, which really is a step forward into a fulfillment of my faith, into the fullness of the Catholic faith. Not a rejection of what had gone before, but really, as I said, the fullness of it. And this is marvelously exciting, and I'm really happy to be able to share in the last three chapters of the book, which are all new chapters, to be able to share something of that journey and why I made the step into the Catholic Church, and something of what it has been like in terms of rounding out my story arc of my coming into the Christian faith and then my maturing in it. So I'm very excited about the way that this book is a more of a complete picture. It now includes more about how it was that I became a Christian in more depth. And it also includes more about what it means to be discipled as a Christian and how to grow in the faith and how it was that I grew in the faith. So I think it's a much fuller, richer book. And I'm very grateful for the chance to have revisited it. Now, one of the things that William, you brought up was that it also has a new subtitle. And this is An Atheist Academic Lays Down Her Arms. And I'm very pleased that I was able to get this new subtitle, because it really captures one of the biggest insights that I had when I was revising, which was in the first edition, sometimes as I reread it, there was a sense that it was about what I had done. Look at how I discovered the truth of the Christian faith and look at how I accepted Christ. It's a little bit me-centered. And one of the things that I was able to put into the new edition was my more mature reflections and recognition that this is not about what I did. It's not what I was strong enough to do or clever enough to do, but it was about what was done for me, what Christ did for me. And really my role in this process was primarily to surrender, to lay down my arms and to allow Christ's grace to work in me. And especially since I was a fencer, I've now retired, but I fenced competitively for nearly 20 years. And this is also something I talk more about in the revised edition. There's more fencing, more books and more fencing. I was able to see the way that in a really exciting way, my own life was itself a metaphor for my conversion, as I learned through fencing something of what it meant to be a Christian. And laying down of arms then became a really powerful image for me, to lay down my arms of defensiveness and then pick up the sword of the Spirit.
Some of what you're saying was making me remember in terms of C.S. Lewis's conversion. He was noting that he wasn't necessarily searching, and it wasn't per se, I don't know if it's fair to say, a willingness, but it was a surrender type thing. And we'll be talking about the influence of C.S. Lewis here in a few minutes. But the next thing I was thinking about in terms of asking you was that some of the people may not be aware, but Dr. John Mark Reynolds, who did the foreword to this edition, also gave an endorsement that can be found in that first edition. This may not seem as significant to some, but what would you briefly share why in many ways it is?
Having Dr. Reynolds do the endorsement in the first edition and then write the foreword in the second edition is meaningful to me personally, because it marks something of the growth that I have had as a working apologist and as a writer. Because I first knew Dr. Reynolds as his student in a cultural apologetics class and was very grateful for the way that he supported and encouraged my work when nobody really knew about it. By doing this endorsement for the first edition. But then fast forward a couple of years, I had been continuing to speak and to do some writing. And Dr. Reynolds, when he became provost of Houston Baptist University, recruited me personally to come and develop and direct the new cultural apologetics master's program at HBU, which is where I am now. So his role in helping me to step forward and do more work and to be more on the front lines of really exciting apologetics work is something that's really, I'm very grateful for. I think another thing that is really interesting and something I'm very grateful for about this new book is the way that it is very indicative of Mere Christianity. I'm at HBU now, and we're very much a Mere Christian institution. And I think it's reflected in the fact that my book, which includes my journey into Catholicism and is published by a Catholic publisher, Ignatius Press, has been gathering praise and support across Christian traditions. So John Mark Reynolds, who's Eastern Orthodox, wrote the foreword for it. And of the folks who have given endorsements, I have some Catholic endorsers, such as Frank Beckwith, Jennifer Fulwiller, but I also have Malcolm Geit, who is an Anglican priest and wonderful poet, author of Signing the Seasons. He said kind words about my book, and also Robert Sloan, who's Baptist. He's the president of Houston Baptist University, also had some words of commendation that appear on the back cover of my book. And this makes me very happy, because it's an indication that Christians can work together and recognize and support each other's work, even when we're in different traditions.
Well, it just so happens that the next question is related to C.S. Lewis, speaking of Mere Christianity, which is the theme that you were just touching on. Now, what role did the writings of C.S. Lewis have in having you consider Christianity?
Oh, Lewis played a tremendous role in my conversion to Christianity, and I owe him a great debt. And in some way, the new book is almost a thank you, because I get to reflect more on his role. And there's a couple of different roles that he played. One of them is that he was one of the ways in which God's grace touched my imagination when I was a child, because I loved the Chronicles of Narnia, along with Lord of the Rings, especially. As a child, and in particular, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader was a place where my imagination was just captured. And there was something that I encountered in his books that was beautiful and solid and true and meaningful in a way that I would not have been able to put words to. And it stayed with me, even though I didn't think about it consciously for many years. And then when I was doing my doctorate and I was writing about fantasy, I wrestled with the fact that I now knew that Lewis's books were explicitly Christian and had a Christian intent. And I was very angry with Lewis for a while. Why did he have to go and put Christian propaganda into these lovely books? But as I wrote, as I wrestled with these books as an atheist, I realized that I wasn't being fair to Lewis, because he's not preaching in these books. He really isn't. he's telling his story, and the Christianity is imbued in it. It's part of the air that you breathe in the Narnia Chronicles. And so as an atheist, I kind of made my peace with him and said, well, you know, I don't agree with these conclusions, but they're still just really great stories. And again, this is, you know, God's grace kind of seeping underneath the doorways and through the cracks. And then later, when I was out in California and I was teaching and I had finally gotten to the place where I was asking questions about the faith, Lewis's book, Mere Christianity, it was extremely important for me because he lays out some arguments for the reality of God and for the truth of Christianity that I found extremely convincing and thought-provoking. And again, he did it in a way that was not condescending. It was not dismissive. It respected me as a thinker. And it said, well, here are some things to think about. And I did think about them. And I found myself, in addition to the other, you know, I was reading a lot more and doing a lot of conversations. So I found myself, based on all of the different things that I was reading, including the historical evidences, coming closer and closer to thinking, well, Christianity might actually be true. And I got to the point, in fact, that based on what I had been learning about, in this case, the cosmological argument, I was convinced that there was a creator. And then the historical argument, especially the work of N.T. Wright, I felt it was pretty convincing that this man Jesus really had done and said what he is claimed to have done and said, and that it seemed quite reasonable and likely, based on the evidence, that he actually had died and been raised from the dead. So my intellect had arrived at a certain place, but I still couldn't grasp what it would mean for God to become incarnate. I was stuck. I couldn't go any further. And at that point, I had an insight, and I turned to the Chronicles of Narnia, and I went and I reread The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and I reread The Horse and His Boy. And it was there in the figure of Aslan that I was able to make the connection, because Lewis was able to show me in Narnia what it might be like if actually the incarnation were true. What would it be like if God became man? And this allowed me to say, okay, I think I get it. I think this is true. And if it's true, this is some glimpse of what it might be like. And that connection was really important for me because it allowed me to take the next step forward.
You've hinted at a couple of words here, or I want to be sure that people understand something that's quite interesting, at least I find, and hopefully our listeners will, and that is reason and imagination are very important words to you. Tell us why this is and how they both played key roles in your journey as you were describing it to some extent, and maybe even comparing and contrast the words, even though they don't have to be on opposite ends.
Well, I think, William, this is at the heart of what I'm doing as an academic, really, and as an apologist, because reason and imagination have really been separated in the modern day. So we have, in Christian thought, for instance, we have people who can make arguments about you know, why we should trust the Bible or that God exists. But if those ideas are just dry, propositional things to be argued about, oftentimes people don't connect with them. And that's where the imagination can be so important, because the imagination provides meaning. It's the substance, really, to give us things to reason about, as Lewis points out. And the imagination is really another way of knowing. It's another way of apprehending and grasping truth, because we can know things imaginatively. We can feel them and know them to be true in ways that are not contrary to reason, but are complementary to it. And so what I experienced in my own life, I had experienced something of God's grace imaginatively when I was even quite young. And I had no rational content to connect it to, no Christian teaching, no understanding that this was related to anything real. And then later, I knew some facts about philosophy. I thought I knew what Christians believed. Actually, it was wrong a lot of the time, but I thought I knew. But I knew them on an intellectual level of, oh, well, here's this idea, and it doesn't mean anything to me. It's not even worth following up. It was when the two began to be connected, when I started to read poetry and to Christian poetry in order to teach it, that I started to recognize that the questions were meaningful, that something like, does God exist, far from being just some philosophical question for philosophy geeks to argue over, nothing to do with me, actually was deeply relevant and meaningful. And that's where the reason, the intersection of reason and imagination was really so important for me personally at the outset, was that it allowed me, well, it encouraged me and allowed me to care about these questions. Because earlier, you know, when I was in my 20s, if someone had presented me with arguments for the existence of God or the truth of Christianity, had given me the same books that I read a few years later, I wouldn't even have bothered to look at the books. I would have just dismissed it out of hand and say, I don't care about that. That's all just silly nonsense. So I had to account for what changed, what made me willing to even consider these ideas. And that was the connection, finally, the connection between reason and imagination. And Lewis is so profoundly important in this because he gets it. He really understands how these two things are so important, because they really had been that important for him. In the story of his own conversion to Christianity, he was profoundly influenced by a conversation that he had with Hugo Dyson and J.R.R. Tolkien, which was precisely about Christ as the true myth, as the story, the one, the exciting, just strange, dramatic story that is also true. And this allowed Lewis to connect the two hemispheres of his life into one. And that allowed him to move forward and to become a Christian. And what he experienced was very similar to what I experienced, or I should say it the other way around, really. And then he goes on in all of his writings to connect the two. So, for example, Mere Christianity is one of his rational apologetics books. It's argument-based, but if you read it attentively, you'll notice it's full of imagery. It's just chock full of images, because he's helping us with the imagination to grasp the truth that he's also presenting by reason. It's a great example of the fusion of the two. And then, of course, in books like The Chronicles of Narnia, the Ransom Trilogy, Till We Have Faces, it's more focused on the imagination, but there's still that undergirding of rational truth in it. It's very much integrated. And so Lewis has been, as an apologist and as a writer, in addition to the fact that he helped guide me into the faith in the first place.
Well, now, in terms of feedback from others, in particular those who profess to be atheists, what has been their response to your story, and also including your answer whether or not this book is just aimed at Christians or for non-believers as well?
Well, this is a great question, because when I wrote this book, and indeed the same thing when I revised it, I really have been trying to just tell my story. I've been trying to say, this is my experience, this is how I came to be where I am, and I'm not explicitly saying, and you should come here too. Now, obviously, I do hope that people will come to faith, and that they will, in a sense, follow my trajectory. I think that's implicit and in the fact that I actually present the reasons why I came to this conclusion. But I've really attempted to focus on, this is my story. This is my experience. And that has meant that for a lot of folks who are not believers, it's allowed them to read this book without feeling preached at, and to engage with it as, you know, an interesting narrative about the way that somebody came to faith. And I'm glad that it has been accessible in that sense to non-Christians. I've gotten a decent amount of feedback to say that it has been not a threatening kind of book, and that's good, because that's an important role, I think, for us as Christians, to be able to share our experiences without pressuring people. And I think that invites rather than, it's actually an invitation to people to come to faith. Now, I have also gotten some very hostile reactions to the book. And I think one of the more common ones, and I think one of the more baffling ones, has been some form of the accusation, well, you obviously were never really an atheist. And in a way, I just don't know what to say to that, because in its essence, people are saying when they make that critique, I don't believe you. You say that you didn't believe, but I don't believe you. And I have to ask myself, so why are you even reading my book if you're not going to believe my own account of my own, you know, mental and spiritual state? You know, I really did not believe. And how do you think that you can second guess my own state? Part of that, I think, is an implicit hostility to the idea that there is any evidence for Christianity, because it was evidence that, you know, shifted my view. I would not be a Christian if I did not believe it to be actually true. And I think it can be a bit threatening to folks. Indeed, it would have been threatening to me to be presented with the case that somebody could change their mind and make such a dramatic change in their lives based on Christianity actually having a case to be made for it. That's a bit of a scary thought. So that's the critique that I've gotten, this idea of, well, you obviously weren't really an atheist. And I just have to shake my head and say, well, if you don't believe me, you don't believe me. But really, when I recount that part of my story, yeah, I really did not believe.
You've touched in certain aspects, but not really directly to the way I'm going to ask the following question here. And that is, what were key hurdles for you in considering the Christian faith? And then also related to that, how do you think this relates to how some have trouble relating Christianity to others who consider themselves to be atheists?
I would say that the biggest and most fundamental hurdle was a deep misunderstanding of what the word faith means. Because before I had a real engagement with Christianity, my understanding of the word faith was to believe something without evidence, or in fact, to believe something that you have evidence for the contrary. And one of the things that I say in my book, and I will repeat it, you know, till I'm blue in the face, is when I was an atheist, I was not capable of believing something without evidence. And that is still true. There's no difference. As a Christian, I am also still unable to believe a reason to believe. And that basic misunderstanding about what faith was really is what kept me from having any engagement with it. Because I genuinely thought that faith meant you quote unquote, just believed. And maybe you believe because you wanted to, or maybe you believe because it would get you something, like God will send you to hell unless you believe in him, but I can't, so what, am I out of luck? And now this is completely contrary to the Orthodox understanding of faith as a response to God's grace that you can actually recognize. Now there's different ways of recognizing God's existence. It could be emotional. It could be experiential. It could be intellectual. At its strongest, it's a combination of all of those things. It's everything. It's incarnational, but it is not less than a rational understanding. It's everything. It's a combination of all of these things. And that was something that I'd never been exposed to that idea. And actually it was C.S. Lewis who really broke that barrier for me in Mere Christianity, where he talks about faith being the art of holding on to something that you're convinced to be true, even when your moods come and go. And that gave me a real aha moment when I thought, wait a second, you know, you could have feelings about God, or you might not, but have you become convinced that he exists? Oh, that's a completely different thing. And once that barrier was removed, that freed me to actually ask questions about, well, what reason is there to believe that Christianity is true? And there are loads of reasons. And there are reasons that will connect more with some people and more with others. It's a cumulative case, really. There's no one, you know, knockout argument. But I think that basic concept of what does it mean to believe was the biggest obstacle for me. And I think it's an obstacle for a lot of other people as well. And I think that as Christians are sharing their faith with others, it really is important to recognize that it doesn't necessarily do a whole lot of good, and it could do a lot of harm, to just encourage people to just have faith, because that probably doesn't mean what you think it means to the person who isn't a Christian. And it can send them to do something impossible. Like, if you just make this square into a cube, like, well, it's a square, it's two-dimensional. I can't just snap my fingers and make it three-dimensional. That's what it feels like when we talk about faith in a very simplistic way. But if we can talk about, well, yes, I do believe it's true that, you know, Christianity, I believe it's true that Christianity is true. I believe that Jesus really did say and teach these things, and that he really did die and was raised from the dead. I believe that the teachings of the church are true because, and then to give these different reasons. And it may be that some of those reasons include experience. You know, I had a profound encounter with the Holy Spirit. I experienced a miraculous healing. These are also reasons. They may or may not be convincing to any particular person, the same way that, you know, a historical argument or a philosophical argument may or may not be convincing to a particular person. But just the fact of being able to say, well, I actually believe because I have reason to believe, even if it's just as simple as the people who have taught me are reliable people, the same way that we trust, you know, books that tell us about mathematics and physics and the law of gravity. Authority is actually a legitimate reason. So I would recommend that for people who are trying to share their faith, that they remember that just being able to say, I believe that Christianity is true because, to be able to give some sort of reason, could be really helpful in helping someone overcome that block of confusion about what faith is. And it's perfectly legitimate to say, you know, there are more reasons for why Christianity is true. I don't necessarily know them all, but I could point you to some resources that could.
And that reminds me, in terms of reading your book, another aspect I think that's worth underscoring is that you had at least one person very strongly try to answer questions that you had. So it wasn't just reading in the Bible and reading books in support of Christianity, but it was someone who was willing to dialogue with you and meet you where you were. And so someone being willing to, you know, journey with you in terms of what your questions and struggles were.
Absolutely. That's really essential. And it is possible to make this sound in some ways too much like a very book-centered experience, because I am an academic. A lot of my life is lived in books. But the role of dialogue was really critical. And in my first experiences in grappling with Christianity, it was my fencing coach. So just, you know, a layman, somebody who was well-versed in these concepts and was willing to talk with me. And more importantly, not just meet me where I was, which is essential, but not be pushy. Because I had encountered pushy Christians before, and they just bugged me. And especially once I began to take it seriously, once I was really interested in finding these answers, it was a really scary process. And I can't emphasize that enough. It is a very scary thing to consider that maybe everything I thought was true is wrong, and that God exists and he's involved in my life. This is terrifying. And so if someone had been trying to be too pushy, I would have retreated into defensiveness very quickly. And so it was extremely important that my coach was able to be patient and not to push, but to answer my questions and to let material. And I want to repeat a phrase that John Mark Reynolds uses often, which I think is so critical. The important thing is that my coach answered the questions that I had, not the questions that he thought I should have. because I didn't. There were some questions that really weren't important to me that I discovered later that I, you know, explored as a Christian, but they weren't pressing for me as a non-believer. And also, this is an interesting thing, William, you mentioned reading the Bible. This may sound shocking, but reading the Bible had almost nothing to do with my becoming a Christian. I read the New Testament or parts of the New Testament, primarily I read the Gospels, as historical documents to learn about who Jesus was, but I did not consider it at that point to be an inspired or holy book. It was just another ancient document, but I felt that it was a reliable historical document, even if it wasn't written by, you know, inspiration from God. And as far as reading any other part of the Bible, no. It had nothing to do with my engaging with these ideas. And so all of my engagement with Scripture actually came after I became a Christian. And I said, all right, well, okay, Christians understand that this Bible is not just a historical document and a book of poetry. It's not less than that, but it's more than that. It's inspired. It's authoritative. Okay, now I will attempt to engage with Scripture. And that's a lifelong process. And actually one that I have become much more engaged with as a Catholic. Actually, I'm much more able to respond to Scripture as a Catholic than I ever was before, which I hear it more and I internalize it much more. But this is a long-term process. And so part of the surprising aspect sometimes about my conversion is that it didn't involve the Bible as much as many people think that these kinds of conversations have to include, because it was meeting me, as you said, William, where I was. And then later on, you know, as I became, when I became a Christian, I was very well discipled in my Anglican church. You know, I had a great pastor who was able to answer my questions. I had friends later on, you know, all throughout, you know, my time as a Christian, I've friends who are further ahead than me in their faith, who have been able and willing to answer questions. And that is so important. Really, it can't be emphasized too much, I think.
Well, it's been really great talking with you, Holly. It seems like we could go on and on because your story is fascinating, and it definitely does point to, you know, Christ and how true Christianity is. But we're going to need to wrap up. But let me remind the listener that the name of your book is Not God's Type, An Atheist Academic Lays Down Her Arms. So, Holly, where can people find your book is the first part of my question. And then second, if you can give us a final summary as to why people should consider getting it.
Well, you can find it on the Ignatius Publishers website, actually both in the hardcover and in an ebook format. And you can also find it on Amazon. And it is available both in the U.S. and in the U.K. So I hope that folks on both sides of the pond will be able to buy a copy of the book. And as for why I hope people will read it, well, I think there's a couple of things that I hope people will enjoy as they read the book. One is, I hope that it will be an encouragement to Christians, because really it's a very hopeful story, because I was not God's type. Nobody, I think, would have expected that this hardline atheist English professor would have a dramatic conversion experience, end up, you know, becoming herself a teacher of apologetics. This is an example of the way that God can reach even the people that we might think are unreachable. And I hope it's also enjoyable as just a good story. It's a true story, but it's also one that is not just a story of my conversion, but also really the story of my engagement with literature. And there's loads of epigraphs in the book that sort of tell their own story arc, and lots of sections that show the way that I responded to literature, to Lewis, to Tolkien, to poets like Gerard Manley Hopkins. And I think that for folks who love to read, that there'll be a particular pleasure in, you know, sharing with me something of my own love of reading and the way that these books have profoundly shaped my life. And this is one, you know, little thing that may be enjoyable for folks too. Especially in the new version of the book, there's a lot of it that's set in Oxford in the later chapters. And I hope that we'll be able to, you know, spend some time with me in the city of the dreaming spires and enjoy that experience as well.
All right. Well, Holly, thank you for joining me today.
All right. Well, it's a pleasure to be on, and I enjoy your show, and I wish you the best.
Well, I appreciate your comments. Well, I'm William O'Flaherty, and let me thank you, the listener, for joining me today as well. Be sure to check the show notes at EssentialCSLewis.com for any links mentioned in this show, as well as for other podcasts. As this interview is being released, I've been doing a series of shows on a book by Peter S. Williams, C.S. Lewis Versus the New Atheist. That series will continue. Of course, if you're listening to this beyond when it's being released, then those shows are available as well as other shows. Again, you can go to EssentialCSLewis.com to be able to hear those, or you can check the direct podcast feed. That address is allaboutjack.podbean.com, Podbean being spelled P-O-D-B-E-A-N. Again, thanks, and be sure to listen for more great episodes of All About Jack.